Welcome back to the second part of our broadcast from the study day Meeting the Machine Halfway. I'm Lotte Juul Petersen, Weising's curator, and I'm here with John Bloomfield, Weising's assistant curator. In the first part of the broadcast, Morgan Quintons gave a very personal account of the scene around arcade gaming in the 90s in South London, where he grew up. In this part of the broadcast, we'll hear from Gary C. Sang-Sang, a residency artist at Weising, and two researchers, Nathaniel Setter and Carly Morgan.
Gary spent a lot of his time at Weising researching interfaces for a film called The Kernel Process, in which surreal imagery and the artist's own voiceover meander through subjects related to skin and surfaces, dreams of subterranean architecture, lizards, latex, and Georges Bataille's infamous description of Ling Chi torture. So Gary was very much interested in looking outward from gaming. He invited Nathaniel Setter, a PhD candidate at Cambridge, who is researching the perspective used in video games, and Carly Morgan, a PhD candidate at King's, who is researching the cybernetic sutures between bodies and machines. For instance, Carly talked about Call of Duty players learning the difference between arm and wrist movement for optimum control in the game, and another game she found called Ozu, which trains hand-eye coordination and reflexes for use outside of gaming.
Thank you.
Okay, so we are going to do a session on kind of me coming at the gaming angle, but more recently via interest in cybernetics, which will hopefully actually be kind of more broadly introduced when Nathaniel and Carly get talking. So I'm on residency at the moment, and these two are both PhD candidates looking into technology at Cambridge and King's London, respectively. And I think, in a way, you're kind of going at like software and hardware, at least in these talks. But I suppose once you bring in kind of ideas of embodiments, that might not so much be the case. But Cardi is going to talk for a bit on the ways in which cybernetic systems infringe upon the actual physical somatic body with the game that's being played, whereas Nathaniel's going to talk a little on perspectives in different genres of gaming, the FPS, the strategy game, and the third person. So they're going to have some presentations.
No
third person view. Yeah, exactly. All right.
Although third person has been lost, I do have two images to start with, just to give you a flavour of what that would have been about had it been part of the talk. And then I'm actually going to start with a little there.
Let's see, are you a boy or a girl? It's a boy. A boy. We've got a son, Catherine. A beautiful, healthy baby boy.
Oh, James. We did it. A son. A beautiful son.
You've got a bright future ahead of you, son. I'm sure of it. Look at you. Look at you. Hi there. I'm your daddy, little guy. Daddy. You're going to need a name, aren't you? Your mother and I have been talking. What do you think about...
Okay, so I want to start with that, to kind of pose the question. What is it which is so strange? And kind of off-putting about this, but also, as we saw, causes some laughter, right? And I think it's the fact it's causing some problematic questions to start with. Why exactly are we starting at the moment of birth, right? And when exactly in the process of birth we started, why is there this flash of light? Why is the father, voiced by Liam Neeson, asking the baby whether it's a boy or a girl, and then what name it wants to choose for itself. Right. So, why is all this going on? And I think this kind of central strangeness or surrealism here results from a clumsy blurring of the narrative and extra narrative elements. So in an attempt to immerse the player into a continuous first-person perspective, the game designer has in fact shattered the unity of that perspective. Which is to say, in trying to align the player with their avatar at the very moment of birth, the very beginning of life itself, all that is really achieved is a reminder of the player's perceptual distance from the avatar over which they have control. And so I wanted to kind of elucidate this clip a little, because I think it demonstrates that the interaction between player, game world, and interface is never stable. The game is always involved in processes of what we might call self-validation or self-rationalization, in which it's trying to justify the existence of its own internal architectures. One of the most powerful means by which this rationalizing process is performed is that of visual perspective. I'm going to define perspective according to a kind of more or less traditional model from art history as the ordering of visual phenomena according to a rational set of rules and codes. In video games, by employing this ordering of visual phenomena, perspectival modes make possible a coherent relationship between player and game world, and as such constitute the basic logic behind the structure of the game's interface. As in the perspectives of it, the turn towards three-dimensional graphics was, I think, a significant moment of video games for this reason. As in the perspectival revolution in painting in the 15th century, flattened planes were no longer deemed adequate for the representation of a multi-dimensional world. The projection of a world into three dimensions involves a precise, geometric schema of reference. Here we have an important general statement to make about the structure of video game perspective. It is not only optical, but specifically mediated by the dynamics of light refraction common to lens-based optical media. So to put that more simply, video games don't tend to simulate the actual perception of the eye, they simulate the mediation of the camera lens. As such, video game perspective tends to have models which we can draw on to understand it from film theory and from art history. So in this talk I'm going to offer a few comments about two of these modes of game perspective. As Gary mentioned, the first person mode, particularly first person shooters, and what I'm calling the strategy perspectival mode, which is the common to strategy video game genre. My interest lies in the way in which these perspectival modes create political structures within video games, and the way in which, through examining these structures, I think we can find conceptual models for political systems at present. I've just put a few images there from 15th century, 16th century perspective to give us a sense. So I want to start with first-person shooter games, FPSs, since I think they reveal the organising principles of first-person perspective in an interesting way. What do I mean precisely by linear here? Well, in the FPS, the world is seen down the barrel of a gun. As such, it involves the projection of lines of reference outwards from the avatar to connect with objects in the game world. So it's a perspective whose primary logic is that of the act of targeting. Whether one is shooting an enemy, opening a door, or initiating a conversation, the interaction can only be performed through pointing the gun at a target. Since vision is expressed only in the projection of lines of trajectory towards an object, the only possible form of interaction is that of the exchange between shooter and their target. Crosshairs or reticule are central to this relationship, and I find this word reticule quite telling. It more generally refers to the grid and the focal plane of an optical instrument, such as the sight on a rifle, which allows measurement, positioning, or aiming. So we can say that the FPS perspective is centrally structured around the actual technical dynamics of a specific military practice, right, the act of sighting a rifle. It's perhaps not surprising then that in video game studies, the academic field to which we kind of belong, political readings of the FPS have generally seen a kind of fascistic mindset here, but I'm not convinced by this reading. I want to suggest divergently that what we are witnessing is in fact an apolitical perspective, but I want to be clear, I do not mean that this to suggest that the game has a lack of political interest or no political meaning by using the term apolitical. Rather, what I mean by apolitical is the sense derived from classical political theory, namely that the game system operates in a state of exclusionary political life. The player and the objects in the game, the player targets, both come into being not through the structure of politics, but through the binary logic of a linear directed action, which is to say there are no citizens in the game, only the targeters and the targeted, or perhaps hunters and hunted. In fact, to pull up some classical political writing itself, we might think that the FPS player seems much like Aristotle's definition of the apolia, the man excluded from the state, who, and I'm not going to read the whole quotation, just part of it, who is mad on war. He may be compared to an isolated piece in a game of Plataea. Plataea is an ancient Greek board game, which is much like chess, but looks more like checkers, but it's commonly used in Greek philosophy as a kind of allegory for the state. So the state of being apolitical is akin to that of a piece on the game board that is separated from its allies, isolated and defenceless, and therefore defined by its lone position facing its enemies, rather than its relation to the fellow citizens of the city-state or polis. To call the gameplay dynamic apolitical, then, is not to say that a first-person game cannot have a political meaning. Indeed, the correspondence with the state of exclusion, I think, makes it all the more significant when the representation of people's places or modes of being in the game's aesthetic or narrative are given a political meaning. To call that a classic example, the fact that this moment from Call of Duty 4 might be familiar with the nuclear bomb going off in the background, the fact that the Middle Eastern dictatorship waged war upon by the player of Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare, is shown to possess nuclear weapons is highly significant politically. So to call the dynamics of gameplay political in this moment of symbolic significance is not to deny the politics of signifying video games. Instead, it is to observe the positioning of the player as a lone entity whose only possibility for action is determined by a binary of target, non-target, shoot, don't shoot. Indeed, to position the soldier as an apolia is, as I'll return to later on, to position them in a highly significant relationship to the kinds of war they're waged today. So there are identifiable antecedents of strategy video games going back to the 1800s, and this is one illustration of H.G. Wells playing what he called Little War games from the Illustrated London News 1913. And actually, H.G. Wells is interesting. He wrote this book, Little Wars, which is basically defined the rules for most strategy board games, which are still in use today. And those descendants, we can think of things like Warhammer, the game Fantasy Battles, and which I was surprised to see when I was finding this photo. It's apparently now out of production. I remember playing this as a child, and I feel like I'm severely dated by the fact that it's now no longer in existence. But I think war games in general are still generally part of the culture. So the limitation with any of these tabletop battle games is that the size and complexity of any game is of course capped by physical restrictions, such as the space for the board, the number of miniatures, and the increasingly complex dice rolls which determine the outcome of actions within the game. The video game immediately resolves these issues by consigning the limitation of these elements to the processing power of the computer on which the game is played. And so it's this freeing of the player from physical limitations which I see as the starting point for the perspective of the strategy game. We see this in the way the perspective is attached to a free-floating camera which can be moved over a battlefield or representative map. However, the game world, like the tabletop boards it descends from, is not an attempt at total representation of a photographic landscape. Instead, it employs a kind of synecdoche, through which a group of three miniature trees, for example, would stand in for an entire forest, and it extends this into systemic functioning. So, for example, a few villagers chopping down trees and carrying wood to a town centre can stand in for an entire lumber production industry. As such, this is a form of synecdoche that enables the creation of economic and military structures within the game, so the basis for the political system of the state. And the form of strategy perspective which I think most interests me is that which appears to combine different representational modes. And I'm going to take Civilization as an example here, because Civ 6 just came out and I haven't had time to play it yet, but I'm desperate to start playing it. What something like Civilization does is it blurs the distinction between the map and the territory, which we see much more solidly in a game like Total War here. So this is clearly the map mode of representation, and this is the kind of synecdoche mode of representation on the battlefield itself. Whereas if we look at this image from Civilization 6, we can see that the two perspectives have been combined or synthesized into one unified image. And in this way, the player's perspective has to incorporate a kind of, what we might call a cartographic global and a panoramic local into one single perspectival frame. So there are a number of conceptual models that we might take to begin to understand this. I'm going to perhaps eccentrically call upon the 15th century, or 16th century Dutch seascape painting as a model. Or specifically the Dutch seascape as it's been interpreted by the German media theorist Bernhard Seegert. So Seegert claims that, this is one of the paintings that he's writing about, the Dutch seascape painting, he claims, is a kind of dual perspective. It's a combination between the perspective of navigation and the perspective of mapping into a unified visual register within painting. For Seegert, this perspective embodies an entire spatial revolution in painting, which is defined by the way the techniques of navigation and mapping operate as methods of space control. So it's a kind of setting up of space and then imposing a rational structure which limits and controls that space. Similarly, I think we can see the strategy game perspective as combining such a local understanding of space based on military command with a global understanding of space based on mapping and geopolitical systems. As such, although the strategy game contains both economic and military structures, it's not quite defined by either. Instead, they are each subsumed under the mode of what I'm tempted to call strategy as such, but really that's kind of a placeholder, because obviously if you say strategy as such, you then need to define what strategy really means as such. It's kind of a placeholder for what this dynamic is, but I think this term strategy is what we need to be getting at. In this way, the in-game political system functions through synthesis of market and military logic into a form of free-floating governance. The player is neither just a bureaucratic administrator nor a military commander, but a synthesis of the two. So, I don't have a discrete conclusion to offer this paper, but I want to kind of exploit that lack of conclusion to offer a reading of just one particular video game, particular instance of the interaction between video game perspectives. And this is an attempt to make use of these concepts I've been outlining and hopefully show how we can involve them in a critical apprehension of video game culture in the present. In 2013, the creators of strategy game EVE Online launched the first-person shooter Dust 514, connecting the two games online so that players of the former would be able to hire players of the latter as in-game mercenaries. EVE Online is such a monumentally complex game, I'm not going to try and summarise it here, but it involves the managing of kind of intergalactic trading companies and everything that statement entails. So the interaction between the two games, I think, exposes some of the structural features of the way one perspective can be put to work by another. The free-floating strategic system of EVE Online puts to work the individual apolitical subjects of Dust 514 for their use of their labour in service of the market-based political interests to perform a game. I think we can read this interaction as an allegory for the ways in which certain operations of state violence are performed today. In using the first-person perspective for this operation, what is made visible is the hidden use of direct, violent applications of force under the free-floating apparatus of contemporary technological warfare. Indeed, specifically, we may think of the way in which, within the borderless distributed war on terror, various roles in the application of force are taken away from traditional militaries and given instead to private military contractors, special forces operators, and drones, all of which exist in spaces of legal exception or with lack of legal definition. Here, the local and direct force serves to enable the global and indirect control or management system by simultaneously being appropriated by its power and excluded from its politics. The player in Dust 514 can only ever use the money of the EVE Online player to increase their usefulness for the latter, buying better guns, armor, and so on. They cannot induct themselves into the political space as such, so as to become an agent in the market. Can I do it? Their economics is a submarket which is employed by, predicated upon, and simultaneously excluded from that of the global system. Meanwhile, the player of EVE Online, like the commander of remote killing apparatuses, drone, for example, is able to employ the workings of the local without ever becoming local, to employ directness without ever becoming direct, and to employ linear optics without ever losing their ability to float from an aerial perspective high above the scene of violence. And so I'll leave you with this image to demonstrate that relationship. Thank you very much.
I was going to print out my talk on paper and then realized, given the theme today, it would be appropriate to read it from my computer. So please bear with me, and feel free to interject at any point to ask questions or clarifications if something is not clear. So Gary has asked me to read video games cybernetically, so I'll crack on with that as my objective. So my talk seeks to constructively antagonize and playfully deconstruct the theme of meeting the machine halfway, positioning itself as a poetic didactic, particularly concerned with what halfway means in this context. I propose a cybernetic poetics whose probing might open up this question to fruitful lines of thinking. Cybernetics has gone through several augmentations over its relatively short life cycle as an independent discipline. It was first theorized by Norbert Wiener, who devised a model of communication that involved different layers of connection in a body or between bodies based on the mechanism of feedback. The property of being able to adjust future conduct by past performance is how he defines it. The input-output loops of transmission define cybernetics as the study of control and communication regulating information patterns, which are adjusted from the inside of a system. Deleuze and Guattari characterize these internally maintained mechanisms as follows. Cybernetic and informational machines reconstruct a generalized regime of subjection. The relation between human and machine is based on internal, mutual communication and no longer on usage or action. But cybernetics, first emerging out of the seminars collectively known as the Macy Conferences in the 1950s and refined and shaped by the provocations of thinkers like Wiener and his contemporary, John von Neumann, has surpassed its introduction as a communicative model of control. Cybernetics has also eclipsed its injection into the university as a set of subjects and methodologies and has moved beyond its mobilization by science, technology, and critical theory as a way of exercising cross-disciplinary study. Cybernetics, argues Radical Collective de Kuhn, is a not-so-new technology of government which, quote, federates and associates both discipline and biopolitics. Cybernetics is not, or not only, a separate sphere of the production of information and communication. Rather, de Kuhn says, it is an autonomous world of apparatuses so blended with the capitalist project that it has become a political project. A gigantic abstract machine made of binary machines run by the empire, a new form of political sovereignty. Examining games through cybernetic poetics is a particularly fertile way to expose the question of humans and machines to scrutiny because, as was explained in the book Games of Empire, video games are not only homologous with the structure of empire that de Kuhn mentions here, they are also, in fact, known to be sharing the same diagrams of production, communication, and modes of capture that empire has via its globally distributed, tentacular, and homogenizing forces. Gaming is a kind of cybernetic governance, and the gaming industry itself contributes to and is moderated by cybernetic forces on the level of the abstract machine of capitalism. To speak about games more generally, however, when a gamer activates a game, let's say Halo, Super Mario, Hearthstone, whatever you like, she also enters into a social, economic, and technical formation by engaging with hardware, software, and intellectual property that act as components in part to a larger social machine. Today, holding a controller, remark the authors of Games of Empire, quote, we are already within an imperial normativity, born of a new machine, a new economic industrial communicative machine, excuse me. In short, a globalized biopolitical machine. To handle an Xbox or a PS3 or Wii equipment or any gaming console device whatsoever means to plug oneself into a network of techno-human relations which incorporates the player into a globally distributed web of commodifying, exploitative, and productive practices. The magic circle cannot hold as games infiltrate the everyday and penetrate the interstitial phenomenologies of digital life. By purchasing a gaming console, how many of you own them or have purchased them? Just a show of hands. Okay, so all of you, by purchasing a gaming console, you are involved not just in the initial console purchase, but likely also that of a subsequent game software. You are fed online subscriptions, wrapped up in complicated discussions on online gaming forums, subjected to music and video services, encouraged to support your favorite streamers, leave reviews on Steam, and purchase merchandise that showcases a whole branded identity built around your injection into a virtual world. Gamers are entrapped in a, quote, grid of machinic coordinates, engineered to the tolerances of corporate profit. But the contamination between bodies and technologies of the grid happens on a smaller scale as well. Video games, especially esports, which is what I'm particularly interested in, entails a form of play that acts as a school for labor, an instrument of control, and a laboratory for commodifying social interaction. Competitive video games and esports, which are not interchangeable terms, are especially equipped to foreground these cybernetic relationships due to the exaggerated gestures and expressive movements of top-level competitive gamers, whose animations become incorporated into biomachinic systems of communication and control, the computer pro-gamer complex, if you like. Despite the prevailing discourses in gaming studies on virtualities and affects, the body is often left behind during critical discussions of gameplay, suspended in a magic circle that strikes me as particularly trite or obsolete, or conceptualized as bodies projected into a field of Tron-like virtual relations where play becomes described as disembodied by default. Affective attunement and cognitive investment have become buzzwords. VR has resuscitated discussions of the body in play, but those who speak of embodiment and materiality should remember that games have always been about bodies and technology. There is no re-embodiment here. The physical bodiedness, not just the embodied projections of the gamer into virtuality, and the actions and gestures the body performs, are central to understanding how bodily labor is both digitized and material, circulating through the gamer-machinic assemblage. Alexander Galway in Gaming, Essays on Algorithmic Culture, remarks that video games are first and foremost an action-based medium. Human actions breathe life into them. Without the gestural feedback and bodily performance of players, and without the very basic gesture of switching on the device in the first place, video games would remain no more than static computer codes and abstract sets of rules. Video game images come into being only when players enact them. Their becoming visible and apprehensible rests on our bodily performance rather than on our gaze. By implication, this means that human action, especially actions of the analog sort, like basic human gesture, are discretized, organized according to quantifiability, and exported to a computer for processing. In this computationalist framework, humans become legible as machines, as information processors to be specific, and play the role of the little pluses and minuses in a chain of machinic activation. This is especially apparent at the level of professional play, as we'll see in a minute, where the figure of the pro gamer is subjected to processes of cybernetic control and can be read through a grid, much like Nathaniel pointed out, of computational intelligibility that transmogrifies her actions into programmable bits of information registered by her peripheral equipment, things like headsets, a mouse, her keyboard. So if you wouldn't mind just playing this video. This is a video of a Counter-Strike player explaining the wrist action. Pay particular attention to this box in the lower left-hand corner. He's talking about the ways in which you manipulate either your wrist or your hand to direct the action of your mouse and successfully target, specifically for headshots.
Recently, I've been getting many questions about wrist aim versus arm aim and what the differences are and when to use which. And I will explain just that in this video. So now, something you gotta understand. Usually in other shooters, you got a fast look around sensitivity and you got a low aim down sight sensitivity. However, in Counter-Strike, for the majority of the weapons, for example like the Tech-9 right here, or also, let's grab the AK again, you cannot do that, so your aim sensitivity has to be your look around, kind of your movement sensitivity as well. And that's usually very confusing for beginners. That's why they have like a super high sense with like 2k DPI and 20 in-game or something like that, and you're just doing 20 360s when they're moving their mouse pad. And you're not gonna be accurate. No matter how accurate you think you are, you're gonna be accurate with a lower sensitivity like that. It's just because the game works like this. Now, the main issue that I see many people have is that, especially if they're using a higher sensitivity, their main excuse is, well, I have enough dexterity with my hands, I can just do everything with my wrist, and first of all, it's very bad to do everything with your wrist. Like, it's very...
Okay, so what's particularly interesting from a cybernetic reading of this is that the control of the hand coordinates the perspective of the avatar in the game, and it's that sort of perspectival rendering that Nathaniel elucidated in his presentation, where we have hand-eye coordination here, in one sense, but there's a double meaning where we have the hand of the gamer coordinating the eye of the camera as well. So invoking a computational framework permits us to see how the gamer shares diagrams of communication, production, and control with computers. Everything is reduced to information, and algorithmic thinking permeates. In this framework, humans and computers are homologies of one another, each equipped with neural networks that circulate information across synaptic flows. The brain becomes an elaborate wetware device, the central processing unit of human activity. This perspective makes humans and machines primed for integration, since they already have the same operations in common. Our computer age possibilitizes the transformation of the subject, particularly the gamer, and reformulates her as a species being susceptible to and compatible with processes of programmability, control, and digitization. But the relationship between gamers and games is more robust than simple homologies or metaphors might suggest. Video games, perhaps, are a contemporary kind of contamination between human and machinic materials, where human and machinic energies cross membranes of silicon and flesh and circulate throughout a socio-technical assemblage in a process of constant informational capture regulated by the flowing of inputs as outputs and outputs as inputs. These cybernetic processes dissolve the boundaries between body and machine, removing the sutures that separate them one keystroke or binary switch or mouse click at a time. Mackenzie Wark, amending a statement by Mark Fisher, asks, "What do we look like from game space? What do we look like to game space? Surely we resemble a Beckettian assemblage of abstracted functions more than we do a holistic organism connected to a great chain of being. As games players, we are merely a set of directional impulses. Up, down, left, right. Or perhaps one that's more familiar to you. Up, up, down, down, left, right, B, A, start." Despite its name, Strands of Cybernetic Materials thought too often transubstantiates material action into mechanisms for social steering, abstracted forms of intellectual labor, or exportations of cognitive capital that circulate in creative economies. But to read gaming cybernetically and reject discussions of the bodily engagement in play is a failure to account for the full three-dimensional and deeply phenomenological experience of playing games. In a Lacanian formation, critics would do well to recall that the virtual is not simply disembodied, the virtual is also the real. Cybernetic readings of games cannot square with Brenda Laurel's view that the computers are merely a theater, or that representation is all there is. Nor is Slavoj Žižek right, who has clearly never inspected a single esports title in his life, when he contends that the player is a, quote, practical solipsist who overlooks the universal sociosynthetic dimension of her act, reducing it to a casual encounter of atomized individuals in the market. This is adamantly not the case, since esports typically also involves team calibration. It's not just the gamer-game symbiosis that is central, but the community coordination and circulations of cognitive energy that link every player together as elements in a chain and concretize them as constantly negotiating, strategizing, and connected units. They perform as abstract machine. I must reiterate that gamer here is not an individuated subject that plugs into a machine and becomes cyborg, but is a figure that is subjected to digitizing processes, conditioned by computational logic, colored by prior gaming experience, and enmeshed in recurring processes of ongoing calibration. Pro gamers are the compass guiding this interrogation because I think they exaggeratedly choreograph all the types of self-programming that are required of gaming subjects, especially the physical actions that are currently understudied in video game theorizations. Pro gamers at the highest level of competition are monitored with biofeedback devices that detect stress indicators like cortisol, prescribe dietary regimens to boost cognitive performance and neural reflexes, cared for by sports psychologists and therapists who caution against repetitive muscle strain. They're shown how to improve their posture, manage aggression, and reduce fatigue by sports physiologists. And they also experiment with nootropics like Adderall or energy booster tablets to enhance levels of alertness and attention. I'll close my remarks with an observation by T.L. Taylor from her book Raising the Stakes, which is the first comprehensive sociological introduction to the world of esports. And she says, "I saw competitive gamers go through a kind of ritual with space. They uniformly would discard the tournament-provided peripherals and would pull out of their backpack their own keyboard, mouse, and mousepad. The player would begin the process of plugging his own equipment in," and the gendering here is quite interesting. When competitors sit down and set you up, you often see them quickly move their mouse back and forth across the mousepad to get a feel for it, to reconnect the embodied action interfacing with peripheral to the digital space. They test the speed, making sure the surface of the mousepad accommodates their movement in just the right way, as we saw in the Counter-Strike video. When they plug in and sync up with the game, you can see them quickly hitting buttons and moving their character around, warming up not only their avatar, but their physical body as well. For expert play to be achieved, the nuanced circuit between corporeality and vitality must be completed. So in closing, a few final remarks. Digitization is the necessary precondition for gameplay, and gaming is a project of ongoing human-machine interaction through a cybernetic enclosure. To play a game is to submit to a process of identity reformulation via computation. Gamers are contaminated objects, infected by the machines from the inside out. And to come back to my original question, where is this halfway and meeting the machine halfway? There is no halfway. Gamers inscribe digitizing processes inside their neural networks and on their musculatures and embed them within their communicative strategies and brace their postures with good computational alignments. Machines are programmed by human beings and inscribed with unconscious bias and directed by symbolical codes amenable to human apprehension and are subject to playful enslavement by the gamers who click furiously on their keyboards, customize and mod their hardware, or exploit glitches in their software. If you think the interface is halfway, think again. The interface is not a halfway point. It is really a kind of stack of imbricated relationalities that is layered vertically and distributed horizontally along networks of human-computer symbiosis. There is no halfway. There is the center of a circle, which is also the world, inscribing proteons made of flesh and silicone in its circumference. So I have one more thing to show you, and this is a game that you play, but you also work, and it's a mouse training game that is supposed to get you to adjust your accuracy and reflexes. Yeah, you mind? You just watch yours. It's called Osu. I don't know how many of you have heard of it. I am absolutely terrible because I don't play first-person shooters, so I have not conditioned myself to respond quickly to it. But the idea is there are several different modes of play, and one of the most interesting or fun ones for you, if it will load, is called beat matching, and that's where it's kind of like DDR but for your mouse click. So there is a bunch of different circles that are coordinated to a song, and you can upload whatever songs you like.
Open, but either you want to quit and start again, or maybe it's...
Yeah. Okay, maybe we can come back to this, and then we can start moving on, but I'll set it up, and you can come up and have a look at it later.
Sure. Should we do it? Right, so...